This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me as our panel here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And Brent Noctegal.
Hi.
The Middle East, that's the place for the biggest news of the week yet again. Last week, it was the massive blast in Lebanon. This week, it is a historic deal between Israel and the United Arab Emirates. There's a lot to unpack about this story. And to do that, we'll go straight to Brent.
Yeah, this was announced on Thursday there at the White House, and President Trump was talking about how he has brought together Israel and the United Arab Emirates. This is a Gulf state that is closely allied with Saudi Arabia, but that has had warming ties with Israel over the past couple of years behind closed doors. And this is one of the nations that was represented when the peace deal was rolled out back in January. This is the peace deal between the Palestinians and the Israelis that hasn't really taken off yet. And so we knew that there was a chance of perhaps normalizing of ties coming in the future between these states. But we didn't know the timing of it. And we didn't know if it was definitely going to happen. But sure enough, it did happen this week. And this is huge in terms of its significance going back in history. Israel only has two prior to this peace agreements. The one that took place in the late 70s between Anwar Sadat, the Egyptian leader, and also Menachem Begin, and then in 1994 with Jordan. And since 94, there's been no other Arab state willing to normalize ties with the Jewish state. That means no international flights from Israel to those countries, no diplomatic relations, no embassies and such. And so Israelis find it very difficult to actually travel to these places. And yet we have a Gulf state, a state that doesn't even share a border with Israel, deciding that it's time to bring the two nations together and normalize their relationship and have a peace agreement that will be signed formally with the partners here, with Prime Minister Netanyahu and also the Crown Prince of the UAE and President Trump. Perhaps sometime in the next few weeks at the White House.
I'd like to start, if you could just briefly summarize why this really does represent a victory for Donald Trump and a real boost as well to Benjamin Netanyahu.
Certainly this is a boost for President Trump because he has said that he's the deal maker in chief and that he wanted to bring peace to the Middle East. And really this could happen in two ways. One, with the actual Israelis and the Palestinians, or it could happen on the wider sphere with the state of Israel and the other Arab states. It seems like Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, has been kind of motivating the second tract where you reach out to the other Arab states first, and then they would help you bring the Palestinians on board rather than the other way around. It's been the modus operandi for 20 plus years that ever since the Arab League came together in the early 2000, 2001 and said, there's going to be no peace anymore with other Arab states unless you first grab peace with the Palestinians, then you first, Israel, get rid of your forces outside of the West Bank, vacate that area, then we'll talk about peace. And that has been upended completely by this decision, saying, no, Palestinian peace doesn't come first. We can have normalcy with other Arab states without that. And so this is a huge win for President Trump. This is right before the election. Really, people have been talking about this being the second most important foreign policy victory that President Trump has had, bringing on board an Arab state that would side with Israel. And so this
The first most important being the withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal.
Right. And these two points are heavily connected as well, as I'm sure we'll get to. So this can definitely help him. You've got a lot of Christians, the Christian evangelical base in the United States that was worried that the peace plan in terms of Netanyahu being able to annex the West Bank, that might not go forward before the election. And some of them were a lot of the evangelicals support the president because of, and one of the main reasons, because of his support for Israel. And so this is just going to bolster that base as well. In terms of...
And before we move on to Netanyahu, there's also talk about how, because UAE made this deal with Israel, that this could very well presage other Arab states in the region following suit, that it wouldn't necessarily be a one-off, but this could actually be sort of the crack in the dam that creates a lot more of these types of deals with other states, I guess enhancing right. that idea that this could, you know, be a deal changer for the Palestinian deal as well.
Yeah, for that, for sure. But now that, you know, the UAE has upset the party line, basically, in the Arab states, that you have to work with the Palestinians first, then that does open the door for other Arab states that will want in on this also. There's been talk that Bahrain is going to be the next one, another small Arab state on the Gulf states, and that they are going to quickly follow suit, perhaps even before the end of the year. The main thing that the Arab states have to counter with, because they get a lot from this. They get trade with Israel. They get Israel's security with help with Iran. They get a lot of Israel's technological know-how, the trade that they can do between the nations. This is important for them. And a lot of other Gulf states will be, or the others will be, interested in this. But they have to counter with their population, because their population, the citizens of these countries, don't like Israel. And have been fed a lot of propaganda against Israel for so long. And so that's perhaps why we didn't see Saudi Arabia come out and be the first, even though they are the biggest dog there in the Saudi Arabian Peninsula.
Well, I definitely want to talk more about that just a little bit later. Go ahead and give us a brief idea of why this is such a boost to Netanyahu.
Well, I think it is a huge boost because he's been facing so much pressure over the last month or so, with these riots against his leadership, with the increasing riots, also because of his the way that he's handled coronavirus, he's been sinking in the polls quite a lot, about 10 points over the past 3 weeks, 3 or 4 weeks.
Wow.
And so if you can look at history, and that's how Israelis are looking at this in terms of history. This is the third massive peace agreement that you have with your Arab neighbors that you're going to be accepted in the neighborhood. And who brought it about? Yes, it was Donald Trump, but yes, it was also Netanyahu, through him and also his advisors for the past two or three years have been working behind the scenes to bring this about. And so with all his failings, you just got another Arab state that's okay with you being in the Middle East. And this is big for Israeli citizens.
So it's interesting to look at this, 26 years since the last time any kind of deal even remotely like this was made. What enabled United Arab Emirates, or what motivated them to do this? What caused them to overcome the opposition to making a deal like this?
The biggest factor is how scared Middle Eastern states are of Iran's rise, and the fact also that you could have a change of administration here soon, and you could have a return to the nuclear deal under the terms that were organized by President Obama, which virtually empowered the Iranian regime, which it reset the Middle East power balance that sought to increase Iran's power and weaken the United States allies, the Gulf states and Israel. And so you have the Saudis, you have the UAE that are strengthening the partnership based on that security necessity, so that in the future there can be a growing power that would hold back Iran. And Israel is a strong, dominant military, the most powerful military in the Middle East, an extension of the United States. And so as the Saudis and even the Emiratis would see it. And so a relationship like that is incredibly important for their survival. It shows that they think that even though we're out of the nuclear deal, even though Iran is on the back foot in terms of its income and its economy, that they're still terrified that Iran has not given up on its ambition to dominate everyone else in the Middle East.
So everyone who's looking at this is recognizing that we're seeing this very clear emergence of these two camps in the Middle East, with Iran on one side and this growing anti-Iranian alliance on the other. Looking at this from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, that's exactly what we have expected for quite a long time. And it's interesting to look at this specific deal that Israel has made with UAE, because prophecy really does give you a different view. There are a lot of Israelis who are celebrating, and they're congratulating Netanyahu for making this deal. People congratulating Donald Trump. Prophecy gives you an idea of what's motivating it and an idea of the outcome, and it isn't so rosy.
Yeah, certainly I can understand that the cause for joy among Israelis and others in the Middle East because of this. But yes, looking to biblical prophecy, we can see that the outcome of such deals is not going to be good for Israel. There's a prophecy we talked about it last week in Psalm 83, which talks about an alliance of nations, of which the Emiratis and the Saudis are going to be part of, the moderate Arab states that come together, and they actually come together to fight against Israel and to destroy Israel. That's going to be their goal. And so we see the emergence of this alliance right now, and it aligns up with all those nations that are against Iran. So you've got Iran in one of these alliances, and the other alliance is made up of nations that are right now allied with Israel, or increasingly allied with Israel, to counter the Iranian influence. But at some point, biblical prophecy says this Iranian influence and the Iranian strength and power and the way that it pushes and all of that is going to be finished, destroyed. It's going to be totally demolished. Then what happens? What happens in terms of the Saudis' relationship, or the Emiratis' relationship, or Jordan's, or Turkey's, or the others' relationship with Israel? What happens then when that joint threat is gone, when the reason for them coming together is gone? Well, the Bible indicates in Psalm 83 that these nations take crafty counsel against Israel. It's crafty, it's deceptive, and they're coming together to destroy Israel. And the deceit in it really does... is really obvious in terms of what we see right now. It's they're deceptive because Israel isn't going to think that they are enemies because they've been working together for so long. And yet it's through that deceit that they are actually going to make a play on Israel as well. And that's what Psalm 83 brings out. Our book, The King of the South, written by Mr. Gerald Flory, brings out all of these details and the timeline to biblical prophecy, how Iran pushes, how there's a counter-alliance, and what that's going to do to the state of Israel as well.
You mentioned about just how much opposition there is in the streets of these Arab states in the neighborhood against Israel, how much antipathy there is for Israel. And it's just interesting how easy it is for those who are looking at a deal like this optimistically to ignore those facts on the ground. But you look at what you said about Psalm 83 and verse 3, it really does reveal the true nature of that confederation that Psalm 83 is describing, that it is an anti-Israel confederation. And suddenly those kinds of facts about what you see in the populations of those Arab states becomes a whole lot more relevant. And it's something that you know that you cannot ignore and expect all of this to work out well. Well, we really appreciate you bringing that to us, Brent. And The King of the South, that booklet from Gerald Flory so many years ago, just gives incredible overview of what to expect in the Middle East. And it really does bring clarity to news items like the one that we're seeing here this week. Now over to Eastern Europe, where an election in the former Soviet state of Belarus saw the nation's longtime dictator win a decisive victory. Well, the people of Belarus are out protesting. They say it wasn't a fair election. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, Belarus concluded their presidential election on Sunday. And as you said, the longtime strongman Alexander Lukashenko, who has ruled Belarus for about 26 years now, is said to have won a landslide victory. The official count gives him about 80% of the vote. But the problem is that there's just all kinds of evidence emerging showing that the election was terribly rigged in Lukashenko's favor, and that the vote count was manipulated to a substantial degree. There has been a great deal of discontent with Lukashenko in recent months because of his, you know, just mainly his mismanagement of the country's beleaguered economy and just a growing list of human rights violations that he has committed. Lukashenko even had his main opposition candidate arrested before the election. So many of the people were unhappy with him. And exit polls show that in some of Belarus's major cities, pretty much the opposite divide for the percentage points between the two main candidates happened. They show the main opposition candidate, which is a 37-year-old woman named Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. They show that she won more than 80% of the vote, and Lukashenko won only somewhere between 10 and 20%.
Wow.
So those are just extreme irregularities. And the people of Belarus are furious about it. Right now, the largest protests since Lukashenko came into power back in 1994 are underway. These people are out in the streets night after night in more than 30 of Belarus's cities, and they're demanding just a fair count of the vote. And then the protests are often getting violent. More than 6,000 people have been arrested so far. Hundreds have been injured by, you know, the police force's truncheons and stun grenades and rubber bullets. Three protesters have been killed. And then on the police side, there have been 40 officers injured so far, some of them quite seriously. And so now the main opposition candidate has fled the country. She's basically in exile with her family now in Lithuania. And she says she's the rightful winner, and she demands that there be a peaceful transition of power. So it looks like there's no end in sight for these very heated protests.
Now, we... I think the average person probably doesn't give a great deal of thought to this little nation in Eastern Europe. We talk a lot about just how important it is in terms of its relations with Russia and how much influence Russia has had over it. It is a former Soviet satellite state. In your view, how does this, how is Vladimir Putin looking at this situation? And what might happen going forward here?
Yeah, that to me is really why this caught my eye. The Trumpet has been vigilantly watching Russian President Vladimir Putin and his various maneuvers with Belarus for many years. And that is, as you said, in large part because Belarus was part of the Soviet Union. It was in there along with Georgia, along with Ukraine, and 11 other republics that were sort of in the Russian periphery. And early in his presidency, Putin called the disintegration of that union the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. So he really looks back positively on the time when all those countries were amalgamated into one under Russia's power. And one of his most urgent goals as Russia's leader has been to bring as much of it as possible back under Russia's control. That's what the 2008 invasion of Georgia was about. That's what the 2014 invasion of Ukraine was about. In both cases, he brought parts of those former Soviet nations officially under Russia's control. In Georgia, actually, it's de facto under Russia's control. But with Belarus, it's already largely under Russian control. Mm-hmm. You know, the two militaries have very close ties. Belarus is a member of the Collective Security Treaty Organization and also the Eurasian Economic Union. Those are both instruments, really, of Russian power. So it's plain that in some weighty but unofficial ways, Belarus is essentially part of Russia. That's why we watch it so closely. But it's incredibly important to Putin, largely because it's a giant buffer between Russia and Europe. So this unrest could give him an opportunity to boost his power even more over Belarus. Putin did send along with his congratulatory message to Lukashenko, he sent some statements saying that he hopes that the two nations will draw even closer economically and politically. And I think that if these protests continue, we could see Lukashenko asking Putin for more help. And something like that could lead to a significant increase in Russia's influence over Belarus. So it's hard to know exactly how it'll shake out here, but we could see Putin accomplish more of his goal of just bringing more Soviet territory back under his power.
We have talked about the fact that Putin actually was considering absorbing Belarus into Russia and creating a single common state. That's the extent of the, the power that Russia seeks to exert over Belarus. Just looking at this prophetically speaking, where would you send people for more information just for the context of what's happening here?
Yeah, that's a great question. We have spoken about the union state of Russia and Belarus. That's it's been in the news quite a lot, even in light of this election. Mm-hmm. This could give Putin a chance to make that a reality. But the Trumpet watches Putin and pretty much all of his maneuvers, particularly those that are frightening to Europe. And we watch all of that carefully because of what Bible prophecy says about the role of Russia's leader in end-time events. Revelation 9:16 talks about a huge Asian army that'll come together and be just a major player in World War III with a force many orders of magnitude larger than, you know, the world has ever seen before. Revelation 16 calls it the kings of the East, with the plural kings there showing that it will be multiple Asian nations. And then Ezekiel 38 tells us that the whole thing will be led by what is called there the Prince of Rosh, or Russia. And Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has written quite a lot about these prophecies over the years, and he has identified exactly who this Russian prince is. In our September 2014 issue, he wrote, quote, "I strongly believe Vladimir Putin is going to lead that massive Asian army. I see nobody else on the horizon who could do that. This much is absolutely certain. The restoring of Russia's power by Vladimir Putin, the Prince of Russia, was prophesied." So it's because of those prophecies that we watch Putin so closely. And if anyone would like to know more about that, I would recommend that they order Mr. Fleury's booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Another story that we in the Trumpet have followed for a long time is the cooperation between Russia and Germany, particularly over the Nord Stream 2 pipeline deal between these two nations that would significantly alter energy politics in Europe and give both Russia and Germany a lot more power. Well, the Trump administration has been fighting this deal. This week it threatened to intensify its opposition, and this has upset a whole lot of people. To learn about this, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, this has become a big news story in Germany, as all of the politicians just talk about how outraged they are about this. So three U.S. senators who are very supportive of Mr. Trump, especially over this, they've written a letter to a Baltic seaport operator in German Chancellor Angela Merkel's home constituency, and they've basically threatened the port's managers with crushing legal and economic sanctions if they continue to support the Nord Stream pipeline. And America's sanctions on this have already been quite impressive in a lot of ways. You know, they put sanctions in place on any company that was helping to lay the pipelines. And you know, pretty much the minute those sanctions were passed, the Swiss company, I think, or Austrian, the company that was laying the pipes quit. You know, they didn't want to go anywhere near the risk of these American sanctions, because it meant being just cut off from American banking system, losing all of their assets in the U.S., etc. It took Russia months to get a ship round that could relay the pipe. And so now they're saying to Germany, well, to these German companies, if you help refuel this Russian ship, or service this Russian pipe-laying ship, well, we'll come after you now as well. But like I said, it's had a furious response in Germany. The premier of the state where the port is based, they called the letter blackmail. A Green MP talked about it being a declaration of economic war. There was a leading social democrat accused America of neo-imperialism because of this. Politico noted, the episode proved yet again, if there's one thing that unites Germans, it's their hatred for the American president. So it's caused a big furor in the news in Germany this week.
Yeah, what you said about just how much Germans are united about hatred for Donald Trump, certainly very true. But when you look at the merits of the American position here, not only is it there's a very strong case for what Donald Trump is doing, but America is hardly alone in its concern and opposition over this pipeline. It's just the only one who has the power to make a difference.
Right. I mean, even Politico in this piece I quoted, they're definitely not pro-President Trump. But even they ask, how can Germans expect the U.S. to use its military to defend their country while they also cut lucrative gas deals with Russia, the country from which it needs protecting? It doesn't make any sense. And like you said, the neighboring countries, Poland especially, they're outraged about this. Poland has taken to calling it the Molotov-Ribbentrop pipeline, about when Germany and Russia betrayed Poland in the run-up to World War II. You know, they feel like they're being betrayed once again by Germany. So, and you know, there's a reason why German troops are leaving, or American troops are leaving Germany and getting ready to deploy to Poland. Poland is very keen on what President Trump is doing here. But Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry had a landmark article on this subject in our Trumpet print edition just, I think it was a year or so ago, but the article was called Germany and Russia's Secret War Against America. But he made a number of points in that article. He talked about how this clearly shows, you know, Germany wants to eliminate NATO. Germany is working against NATO. This pipeline deal directly undermines NATO. And in that article, he said many elite Germans feel their nation has now gotten all it can from the U.S. and they're ready to move on. You know, they did gain a lot of benefits from NATO. NATO paid for Germany's defense, so Germany could focus all of its resources into building up economically. But now Germany wants to be this independent power. Mr. Flurry wrote that they want modern Germany to assume more power of its own in the spirit of the Holy Roman Empire. They want to establish Europe as a mighty German-led superpower. And so they want to find ways to undermine NATO, and this pipeline deal does that. It also gives both Germany and Russia the opportunity to weaponize energy. You know, Poland or Vladimir Putin, he uses energy repeatedly as a weapon. You know, do what we say, or we'll cut off your gas supply in the middle of winter. How are you going to heat your homes then? And even more subtly, you know, if you're a nation like Belarus that's relatively close to Russia, you get cheap gas deals. If you move away from Russia politically, we'll charge you 2-3 times more for your gas. And you know, now what this means is with the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, that Russia can cut off, say, Poland from its gas supply without cutting off those countries that are downstream from Poland. It used to be if Russia cut off Poland, it would be cutting off Germany as well and France and some of these other countries. Russia would lose a whole lot of money. Now they lose much less. They can keep supplying those other countries through Germany. Mr. Flurry said this places a sharp edge on Putin's energy weapon. And then Germany, on the other hand, well, now they have kind of Russia's power. They have the control of the taps of the countries in Western Europe. So you see them benefit. But then also you just see this deal, and this is what another aspect Mr. Flurry focused on in this article. It's a deal between Germany and Russia, which is something we see throughout history. You know, Germany and Russia, they have no good natural boundaries. So if one of them wants to expand outwards and invade other countries like they've done repeatedly, they need to do a deal with each other. They need to find some way to guarantee, you know, Germany needs to find some way to try and make sure Russia doesn't invade them or pressure them while they're off doing something else. And so this deal is a powerful sign that they're getting ready to get more involved elsewhere in the world. Mr. Flurry writes, the fact that Russia and Germany are charging ahead with Nord Stream 2 today, despite objections from other European nations and the United States, is even more reason to believe that these two may already have worked out a modern Molotov-Ribbentrop deal. History shows that Germany and Russia are not actually partners, and Jeremiah talked about that. They've got a lot to fear from each other. And just because Germany is working with Russia, it doesn't mean they don't fear Russia. You know, they're working with Russia because they fear Russia. But then Mr. Flurry writes, when they enter into peace deals and economic partnerships, it is a sign that either or both are preparing for some kind of imperialistic exploit. This makes the Nord Stream 2 deal extremely concerning. This is why we pay close attention to this. And then Mr. Flurry, in that rest of that article, he goes through several Bible prophecies. You know, Jeremiah chapter 31 talks about a seething pot that overflows and invades other nations, and shows that what we're seeing is Germany and Russia getting ready for this kind of action. He says cooperation between Germany and Russia is setting the scene for a huge seething pot to spill over into these nations. And you know, that's what we're seeing there. You can read more about that in that article, Germany and Russia's Secret War Against America. And I'd also recommend Mr. Flurry's book, Germany and the booklet, Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. That helps put this whole, or show what the Bible says about modern Germany, shows what's happening here, but also shows God's purpose for modern Germany and putting that in that overall prophetic context and that overall context of good news, because there is a fundamental good news behind, you know, God has a very positive purpose behind all of these news events, and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire can help put that into that overall context.
You know, you were mentioning just how upset Germans are over these moves that the Trump administration is making to try to shut this pipeline deal down. And it's worth noting the Psalm 83 alliance that we were talking about at the beginning of the program with respect to these Arab states, that they are taking crafty counsel together in an anti-Israel alliance, that Israel includes the United States, and that the Psalm 83 alliance includes Germany as well. And we do see from Psalm 83 and many, many other prophecies that are described in Germany and the Holy Roman Empire, and that article from Gerald Flory that you mentioned, Germany and Russia's secret war against America, that show Germany's intent. It is aimed against America in a way that really is going to shock the world. Anyone who's not familiar with prophecy, that is, but it's so plain in prophecy what Germany's real intent is, and you see that in its response to what's happening there now. We do appreciate that, Richard. Now over to American presidential politics. Joe Biden chose his running mate this week, and if you want evidence of just how far left, how radical the Democratic Party has become, you got it this week. For this story, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, we've got just about 3 months till the presidential election comes up, and we're getting more and more evidence of this, the exact type of campaign the Democrats plan on running. This week, as you mentioned, Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden chose Kamala Harris as his vice president. The media is making a lot of the fact that she'll actually be the first black woman to ever appear on a major party ticket. And they're saying that she's a pragmatic moderate who's really going to help Joe Biden reach out to independent voters, which is an interesting assessment. I guess moderate and conservative are relative terms depending on where you think the center is. But when they did a voting analysis of the voting records, a lot of these analyses show Harris as the most far left senator in the Senate, and then there's been some other voting record analysis that dispute that finding, saying that she's actually the second most liberal senator in the Senate after Elizabeth Warren. So either Warren or Harris are the most liberal senator in the U.S. Senate. So if Harris is a pragmatic centrist, then everybody else, including Bernie Sanders, is a right-wing conservative.
Right. So, yeah. So what do you make of that, the fact that Joe Biden picked her?
Well, I think it's I definitely think Joe Biden's not the one who's making those decisions, but it's
Well, tell us about that. First of all, maybe just a little bit of her background, a little more about her background, and then what you think is really going on here.
Yeah, well, yeah, I can back up a little bit, because if you're actually looking at just aside from her voting record, like how radical Harris's past is, her father was quite well known, Donald Harris. He was a Jamaican-born professor who was really well known for bringing Marxism or Marxist ideas to Stanford University. I looked up the old newspaper clippings from when he was hired at Stanford University, and they said they hired him after a 6-month round-the-world search to find the most qualified Marxist professor available. So I guess any of the American-born Marxists weren't quite Marxist enough. So they found one from this Jamaica to bring in, and then he went, well, before he was a professor, he came to America, studied at University of California, Berkeley campus, and that's where he met Harris's mother, and at the Trevor Luden over at Epoch Times had even found photos showing that during the early years of their marriage, they took a baby Kamala out in a stroller to like anti-Vietnam War protest. So she's been involved in far left protest from the time she was a baby till today. And then her voting record definitely shows that she's, even though she's more moderate in her rhetoric than Senator Bernie Sanders is, she doesn't come out and just openly admit she's a Democratic Socialist. Her voting record shows that she's just as far left as Senator Sanders, if not more so. And it's generally a lot of analysis, including Lee Smith over at the Tablet. It's actually thinks that she was probably former U.S. President Barack Obama's preferred pick to be the presidential candidate this election. She ran for to be the Democratic nominee. She just didn't do well in the primaries, and so they had to go with Biden instead. But there's definitely a number of analysts who believe that Obama's the one that kind of nudged his former vice president to choose Harris as his vice president to get her on the ticket. To get her on the ticket. If she couldn't get on the ticket through the primary process, at least get her on the ticket through the in the vice president process.
That really is an interesting point. The fact that it does seem like she is very ideologically aligned with President Obama, and that he would support her, given what Gerald Fleury has been talking about with respect to Obama's influence continuing to extend beyond his administration.
Yeah, she's even been referred to as the female Barack Obama because their life stories are kind of similar. Their policies are very similar. Even their rhetoric, the way that they downplay how radical they really are, is similar. And we do have an article we can put in the show notes, America Has Been Fundamentally Transformed, where Mr. Fleury, he's going through Barack Obama's past and current influence on the United States, just explaining the biblical relevance of this pushing America towards the far left and the division it's creating. And I think that's going to be one of the big results of having Harris as the vice presidential nominee, is going to be more division in America. If I would have been Joe Biden's chief campaign strategist, I would have advised him to pick a truly moderate Democrat from maybe Pennsylvania or Wisconsin who would help him win swing states if he actually wanted to be president. Choosing a far-left radical from California may not help him win this election, but it's definitely going to divide liberals from conservatives even more than they already are, mm-hmm. Which is something that Mr. Fleury brings up powerfully in that article about just how the unprecedented levels of political division we see in America today are largely things that the Obama administration caused. And then even tying that into prophecies like the one in Isaiah 1 and verse 7 about it getting the division getting so bad that cities actually burn in like urban warfare, civil warfare. The type of violence we haven't seen since the actual first civil war, mm-hmm. Is something that the Bible's prophesying. And then like you can't have a civil war without this just bitter division between people, and picking someone like Harris as your vice president candidate, it's like I said, it may not help you take back the White House, but it's definitely going to create more division in America.
Mm-hmm. Seems to be the theme of so much of what's happening in America today. America has been fundamentally transformed is the name of the article from Gerald Fleury that we will link to in the show notes for today's program. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. We'll take a short break. Lots more important news coming up. Stick around.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
We spoke at the beginning about the landmark agreement the Trump administration mediated between Israel and the United Arab Emirates. We have a couple of stories to begin the second half that show other areas where Washington has been busy on the foreign policy front. First, regarding Taiwan, a serious point of contention with China, which claims Taiwan as its own territory. But this week, America staged its highest level visit to Taiwan in 40 years. To learn why, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, it was back in 1979 that the United States decided to sever official ties with Taiwan and to instead establish official ties with China. You know, the way China runs things, no country can have official ties with both because, as you said, China claims to rightfully own Taiwan and to have control of its 23 million people. And America thought that by reaching out to China diplomatically and economically that we would, you know, cause the country to reform and even democratize eventually. And of course, we know that that didn't work out. All we did was make China richer and more powerful, but if anything, it became more authoritarian, more oppressive, and more opposed to the United States than ever, partly just because we enriched the Communist Party with that outreach. But anyway, ever since then, the U.S. has kept most of its meetings with Taiwan kind of behind closed doors. We've still been close with Taiwan. We've recognized the need to support and defend them, largely as part of the effort to contain China. But we kept it all pretty low-key, just to avoid infuriating Beijing. But this week, though, the U.S.'s top health official, Alex Azar, and a delegation of other U.S. officials met with Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen. And the visit shows, I think, just how tense things are right now between America and China. It also shows how important Taiwan is in the ideological battle that's underway right now between America and China. And, of course, China was furious about this meeting. They scrambled a couple of fighter jets near Taiwan just before the talks began. But that's just, you know, business as usual for China. And one of the big results of this meeting was that Taiwan is poised now to increase its defense spending by more than 10% this year. So that'll bring it to $15.4 billion, and a big chunk of that will go to buying American-made sea mines and cruise missiles. So those would be used to deter an amphibious landing by China, you know, with a potential invasion. So it is mainly designed to deter China as China just keeps becoming more and more aggressive.
Maybe this is just me, but you can tell me your view on this. It seems like America's commitment to Taiwan's independence is really nowhere near what it would actually take for Taiwan to stand up against China.
I would say that's accurate. Yes, we do make a show of support, and I think this meeting was not insignificant by any means. You know, it was the most high-level visit that's happened since 79. But at the same time, we're not an official treaty ally with Taiwan. If they were to come under attack, I just don't know if we would have the resolve to, you know, to really help them in a meaningful way. And Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has said that America's weakness and our broken will, you know, our broken pride in our power will eventually cause Taiwan to be conquered by China. He wrote an article back in the late 90s. It's called Taiwan Betrayal. And one part of that says, how could anyone fail to see that Taiwan is destined to become a part of mainland China? It's going to happen for one reason, because of a pitifully weak-willed America. And from there, he explained that this understanding was based on Bible prophecy, mainly one in the book of Leviticus, which says America and its will to use its power would be broken. So, you know, with this meeting, the U.S. has made a show of support for Taiwan, but I think it's temporary. This kind of support won't last long. And as the U.S. keeps on weakening and keeps on being torn apart by the internal problems that Andrew was discussing in the first half, it's easy to see how this forecast by Mr. Flurry will soon come to pass.
You know, so much of what we're talking about on the program today, it shows what the Trump administration is doing in exercising American power in ways that, if America were to really go fully after pursuing some of these aims, these policies, it really could have a tremendous impact on the world. You think about just how much of an impact the Trump administration's decision regarding the Nord Stream pipeline affected that. I mean, it essentially shut that down for a time, maybe enough time to buy Poland enough of space to protect itself from Russia to some degree. But just looking at all of these things through the lens of Bible prophecy and knowing the ultimate outcome, and you just see how the measures don't go far enough to actually make a difference. And in some ways, what America did here, it almost feels like it's more of a provocation for China than it would be something that would actually push back against China. But at any rate, we will link to that article from Gerald Fleury, Taiwan Betrayal. We also have another article that we will link to. Will Emperor Xi Jinping use his vast power to seize Taiwan? Go check both of those out in the show notes for the program today. And thank you for that, Jeremiah. That deal between Israel and the UAE certainly increases pressure on Iran, but it's not the only way that America stepped up its pressure on the Islamic Republic this week. To learn what else it did, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Back in May, there were 5 tankers of gasoline that were sent from the Iranian Republic all the way across to Venezuela. Venezuela is struggling, obviously, down there because of its own decision to follow communism. And even though it sits on the world's largest oil reserves, it's unable to convert that to usable fuel. And so Iran has been helping out Venezuela. They sent 5 ships there with great fanfare back in June. And well, in May, late May, and they tried to do it again in July. And it turns out, as reported by the Wall Street Journal and others, that the United States has taken 4 tankers that were bringing fuel down. There is dispute whether the tankers themselves were taken out in international waters or just that the fuel itself was siphoned and then brought to the United States. Over 1.1 million barrels, about $45 million worth. This is after there were federal prosecutors that were trying to, or that had requested by the United States to go ahead and take this fuel because it was organized and set up by the IRGC. That's the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, or Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, that is a United States designated terrorist entity. And so anyone caught doing business with that, such as these tankers and the insurance carriers and such that aren't necessarily Iranian, they can suffer secondary sanctions by the United States. And so it seems that after the United States let 5 go, that President Trump, I think, was pretty upset by this, and he arranged federal prosecutors to go out there and definitely find out where this was, get the court order to go and take this gasoline or this petrol, and they did that this week.
Here again, you have the Trump administration trying to undo damage that was done by his predecessor here with respect to Iran's influence in Venezuela.
Yeah, there's plenty of evidence to show that, you know, Hezbollah and the IRGC and Iran's influence in Venezuela is huge, and it is propping up the Maduro regime down there. And this was done under the nose of President Obama. And President Obama instructed many different officials in his government agencies to just look away, look in a different direction, and allow it to take place because he was pursuing the grand old deal, the Iran nuclear deal, that would reshape the United States, but also reshape America's backyard as well, allowing Iran to head into the Western Hemisphere. And Mr. Fleury really goes and talks about the roots of why President Obama would do that in directly relation to Iran, the nuclear deal, and giving them a free pass in his story from the most recent Trumpet magazine, and it's entitled The Barack Obama Mystery.
All right, thank you. We will link to that in the show notes as well. Last week's visit by France's president to Lebanon shows his determination to extend European influence into the Middle East. More evidence of that this week in another part of the region. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, for a few weeks, there's been a standoff building between Greece and Turkey. Turkey wants to go and drill for gas in what are essentially Greek waters. This week, French President Emmanuel Macron got involved, and he has instructed French forces to go to the Eastern Mediterranean so that they can provide military assistance to Greece. It really raises the stakes in what we're seeing in this standoff. But what I also want to focus on is it illustrates Europe's commitment now to protecting the Middle East and especially the Mediterranean. The Wall Street Journal wrote that France has become more embroiled in conflicts across the Mediterranean as the U.S. has disengaged from the region in recent years. So when you look at Emmanuel Macron in Lebanon last week, when you look at the role that France and Germany are playing in East Africa, when you look at the way that Europe is imposing an arms embargo in Libya, you're seeing now in country after country after country, Europe really is the power that is taking responsibility for everything that's happening around the Mediterranean. 10, 20 years ago, this would have been the United States. But Europe has stepped up to do this. And I think when you look at the French relationship and the Franco-German relationship, that's a very close relationship. Mr. Flurry's made the point in the past that sometimes Germany will get France to do things because it draws less attention when it's France. You know, if it was Germany mm-hmm. that was involved in all of these areas, and they're involved in some, but then it would draw much more attention. But you know, what you're seeing here is just a very direct, very clear fulfillment of a prophecy in the Bible. Daniel chapter 11, from about verse 40 onwards, talks about this clash between the king of the north and the king of the south, these two powers. And it tells us that this clash occurs revolving around the Mediterranean and the Red Sea, revolving around these trade routes. You know, it talks about the king of the north being allied with Egypt and Libya and Ethiopia, these biblical territories that were on the Mediterranean and the Red Sea and on these crucial trade routes. And Mr. Flurry, in his book, The King of the South, draws attention to that and talks about how, while Iran's strategy revolves around, you know, getting control of these trade routes, what do we see this week? It's about Turkey. It's about a different power. But we see Europe very quickly responding when those trade routes are threatened, when there's the talk of some kind of military activity with these trade routes. You know, Daniel chapter 11 talks about Iran pushing at Europe. And you can see now, okay, it's a different nation causing trouble, but Europe will respond very quickly when those trade routes are attacked. And so I'd really encourage you to read that book, The King of the South. There are so many details in that prophecy in Daniel chapter 11 that is written thousands of years ago. And that booklet really mines those details out. And it's a great way to see the Bible come alive as a now book accurate for world news today.
All right. Thank you for that, Richard. One final story. Within America's academic community, it's not very difficult to get in trouble these days, to fall afoul of the very stringent laws of political correctness. For example, try saying that male and female are biological categories. For proof of this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, just for proof of how bad the cancel culture is getting in America, there's an evolutionary biologist, Colin Wright, who has pretty much had his career ambitions to become a professor scuttled by the fact that he believes that male and female are biological realities. He got his PhD in evolutionary biology from the University of California, but then just recently wrote a piece about how after he graduated, he got a job as a managing editor for Quillette, but was applying for a professor positions, but all the big job, or at least one of the biggest job boards he put his name on, he started getting reviews that, like, well, you can't hire him because he's a transphobe. And the reason they were saying he's a transphobe is he actually wrote an article for the Wall Street Journal in February titled "The Dangerous Denial of Sex," where he says the statement: "It's one thing to claim that a man can identify as a woman or vice versa, but increasingly we see a dangerous and anti-scientific trend towards the outright denial of biological sex." And he's coming under heavy fire for even saying that you can be a man or a woman. His critics in academia is like, no, like, biological sex is a spectrum, not gender, but like, sex is a spectrum. And then he's making the logical comeback, well, it's like, well, either you have a Y chromosome or you don't. There's only two options. But when I saw that, it reminded me of how far things have come in the past decade. Because in 2008, Ben Stein produced a documentary called Expelled, where he was talking about how basically biologists being forced out of academic positions for saying that creation was real, that there's like scientific evidence of a creator, and then being fired for even holding that opinion. Now it's actually gotten to the point where they've forced all those people out of there, and they're even looking at firing scientists who are saying that, like, well, male and female are real. They said not even denying that you could be a different sexual orientation or a different gender identity, but actually denying the biological reality of sex itself.
This is a remarkable trend that our editor-in-chief has written about quite a lot. He has an article that we will link to in the show notes called A Dangerous New Age of Worshiping the Will. Very important article exposing this trend. Give it a read. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. And thank you to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Thomas Paine: "He who dares not offend cannot be honest." Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.